So for my part, welcome again to you all. It's wonderful to be here, and I thank God for you. I thank God for this opportunity to teach with you. If I teach a lot, but this is certainly one of the strongest teaching experiences I have each year. I stand up hundreds of times each year before people in different parts of the world, and you're about my best group. And so what I like about you is you're willing to follow, and we try to go as far as we can go into the mysteries. And it's your desire for God, and it's your energy, and it's your prayer for me that lets us go there. Your charity among yourselves to each other lets us go there together. So we trust in God for this retreat and the time together. For about the first time in 4 or 5 years, the phrase dynamic tension is not in the title of the retreat. Those of you who are here for the first time, for 4 or 5 retreats now, we have been concentrating on something I called the dynamic tension between cross and resurrection in the apostolic preaching about Jesus. That the announcement about Jesus holds cross and resurrection in this incredible kind of tension, such that the Jesus whom we know, who is Lord of glory, is known when his cross is announced. This incredible mystery. It's the scriptures that teach us that. And we worked on that idea for several years in general through the whole theological tradition. And then we focused on the Gospels in general for that, always calling it the dynamic tension as expressed in the Gospels, and then dynamic tension last year in the letters of Paul. Dynamic tension is still the topic. It's always the topic of the scriptures. But I thought, well, I can leave it out of the title at least. And in the same way that last year we concentrated on the writings of Paul, slowly but surely, as I was trying to think what to do this year, I decided on settling in on the Gospel according to John, and have given the title to the retreat, Jesus, the glory of God as revealed in the Gospel according to John. I want to come quickly to the topic of the retreat itself, but before we do that, I would like to deal with some practical questions about your schedule. If you could open your conference booklets to the first page after the title page and look at the schedule together. Father Edmund already alluded to it, that all the times for the monks' prayers are listed there, and you're invited, you're not required, but you're invited to join us at any and all of those. But it's a clue for your retreat in any case. I always like to say the retreat is not simply my conferences. The retreat is all day long. And the day, the monastic, we have you live the monastic day with us. And the monastic day pulses along between work and prayer. And we go to prayer, and then we go to work. And our work in these days will be conferences and study time on your own and time together. And then prayer, and then work. And prayer and work and that being together. So just to understand that we have arranged your schedule around the monastic prayer for that reason. Tomorrow morning we will have the first conference at 9:45 here. I'll let you find your way to the prayer and breakfast. That's clear enough. But be here together for our first conference at 9:45. But I want to alert you to a change that we need to make in the afternoon schedule. We try to have a large block of time in the afternoon free, and you still will have it, but we're going to have to shift it to the other half of the evening. To the other half of the afternoon. So the conference tomorrow afternoon, rather than being at 3:45, will be at 1:45. I'll remind you of that tomorrow, but I want you to plan that accordingly. We'll be done by 3, so you'll still have a block of 2 hours of free time. We have to do that because actually the monastic community has a meeting tomorrow, and I need to be at that meeting at 3 o'clock. But for the rest, the conference schedule there, I'll remind you as we go. Then, if you turn the page, you can see that we have an outline of the Gospel of John, and my goal for tonight's conference is to move through this outline and show you how you might make use of it. But before we do that, let me just say a few things in general about why I chose the title Glory of God, the glory of God as revealed in the Gospel according to St. John. We will see as we read this text that glory is a very important and key word in the Gospel, occurring at critical moments, and we'll read some of those texts together. What is glory, and what will we see it to be as this evangelist speaks about it? Well, one of the ways, I think, being fair to... It's a word that occurs throughout the Scriptures. The evangelist John is borrowing his concept from the way the word occurs throughout the Old Testament. But we could say that glory is the experienced presence of God. Let's start as that as the first definition. Glory is the experienced presence of God, or we could say God as perceptible. God as perceptible. Glory is God as concrete reality, as appearance, as quality, as palpable presence. If God comes, there's glory. If God's here, there's glory. And our perceiving that is what the Scriptures in general mean by glory. God lets himself be known in human experience, and at the same time, he always overwhelms it. So everything, all our knowing of God is here in this world of ours and in our own human experience. And yet, he always overwhelms the one experiencing and the experience and the categories of experience. And that overwhelming is glory. A word for that. We need a word for that overwhelming. And the word that the Scriptures use for it is glory. It is the distinctive quality of the divine. I like to say it's God's godness. What's godly about God? His glory. So the glory of God is found in Jesus. In other words, in Jesus, God is perceptible. In Jesus, God is being God. In Jesus, God is known as God. And these are categories that this evangelist wants to use to speak about Jesus. Matthew, Mark, and Luke don't use these categories. They've got other good, useful categories too. But we're going to talk about what are the intentions of this evangelist and why he writes this way. Glory, according to the Scriptures, or the scriptural world of the Old Testament, is something that belongs inalienably to God. You know lines like this. I just take one of 100 possible. It's Isaiah 42:8. I am the Lord, that is my name, my glory I give to no other. Not because he's being selfish or anything. He can't. He's God. We're not. I alone am the Lord. I give my glory to no other. Yeah, we'll see. He does. But until we understand that inalienably glory is God's, and it's what God is, then we will not be prepared to take the measure of what God has done in revealing his glory in Jesus and in Jesus' giving that glory to us. I'm already speaking the way the evangelist does. Those are his categories. Right? That's where we're going. The glory of God, which belongs to him and to no other, also, according to biblical categories, is going to be part of the destiny of human beings, because we are made in the image and likeness of God. So we are made in the image and likeness of the glorious one. It's part of our destiny. The essential revelation of all the New Testament, you could say, is the connection of divine glory with the person of Jesus. I think you could fairly say that about all the New Testament, but especially the Gospel of John or the Johannine writings. You know that word, Johannine? That's an adjective which means the John writings. Okay, so I'll be using it. The John writings. The Johannine writings are the Gospel of John, the three letters of John, and the book of Revelation. The Johannine writings. The Johannine writings, but the New Testament in general, shows us that there is an essential connection of divine glory with the person of Jesus. You want to know something about Jesus? What you're knowing about is divine glory. And this glory is his gift to humanity. The work of Jesus himself, from the moment of his incarnation to his death and resurrection, the work of Jesus is to bring humanity into the glory of God. Each evangelist has his own way of speaking about Jesus. We are going to try to zero in and take account of the particular way in which this evangelist does. You know that it's true of all the Gospels, that the Gospels are not immediately interested in giving objective accounts about Jesus, but they're interested in giving insight into the figure of Jesus. And so we want to take account of, how's this guy telling a story? A lot of people knew Jesus. And you ask any one of them, what was he like? Everyone will tell it differently. The differences in the Gospels are, how could there not be differences in the Gospels? They're not contradictory information. They're contradictory, the complementary approaches to understanding the meaning of Jesus. Well, the evangelist John is an old man's writing, decades later, and very mature kind of writings about Jesus. And the Jesus that he knows and announces is a glorious Jesus. And he can't remember Jesus and can't tell any stories about Jesus and can't recall any words of Jesus without remembering all the glory that was there. That's his style. You know, I've said to you before in different contexts that when we spend time in the Scriptures, and this is especially true of when we spend time in the Gospels, the figure of Jesus slowly delineates itself before us. And what we experience in Jesus, of course, is divine glory. And so it will be in human categories, but they will be overwhelmed. Slowly but surely, the more time we spend in John's Gospel, we'll be doing it during seven conferences, the figure of Jesus delineates himself before us. The figure of Jesus. Jesus is present as we speak about him. But in the particular way that the Spirit-inspired evangelist delivers in this text. This is why I've chosen this particular icon as one of two icons that we're dealing with. I would call this a Johannine Jesus. Johannine Jesus in the sense of it's otherworldly, it's majestic. It's not like what, I mean, Jesus didn't really look like that, you know, nobody does. That's a figure filled with glory. It's a sense of majesty. It's a It's an icon in which at one and the same time the divinity of the figure and the humanity of the figure emerge. This is not a Brother Claude icon. This is by a friend of mine named Michael O'Brien, who lives in Canada. But just personally, I'd like you to know that, and he gave this to me many years ago, this hangs on the eastern wall of my cell in the monastery. And for years, I've prayed facing east in front of this, so I'm sharing a lot of my own vision of Jesus, but very much marked by John. Blue is in iconography is a color meaning divine wisdom. And we'll see Jesus as a wisdom figure moving through the Gospel of John. The book in Jesus' hands always symbolizes his knowledge of the Father. And he opens the book. He alone is able to open it and reveal it to us. So more on this icon as we move through the days. This icon, which some of you know from before, is the traditional way of presenting the evangelist John. So this is our evangelist here. And it's a traditional way of presenting the evangelist John in the embrace of Jesus close to his heart, because John is identified as a figure that we hear about in John's gospel called the beloved disciple, who was said, only in John's gospel do we have this detail, that he rested his head on the side of Christ during the Last Supper. And the church early picked up on that the author of this text rested his head on the heart of Christ a good long time. Let himself, the great third century commentator on the gospel, Origen, says, you want to understand John's gospel, the reader has to rest his head on the side of Christ the way the beloved disciple did. And that's what we have here, the tenderness of Christ, the embrace of Christ, the evangelist's hands opened, and Jesus with the scroll in his hand, another way of representing his knowledge of the Father. He is going to reveal all of his knowledge to the Father, to this disciple. And the colors here are red and blue and gold. The red signifies his humanity, human blood. Blue, divine wisdom. Gold, his divinity. And his colors are reflecting up on the red humanity of the beloved disciple. And he's slowly taking on the blue and golden hues. All of it's happening at Mount Angel. That is to say, okay? All of it's happening here. Okay, this icon hangs in the part of the monastery where the new monks live, and we teach them that it's the revelation of their own vocation, and so they forked it over for 4 days for you and. As they see their empty wall, they are reminded to pray for you, and they will be doing that, okay? So let's look in the conference booklet at the outline that's there for you, which, probably violating copyright laws, I have copied from a very fine commentary on the Gospel of John by Raymond Brown. And it was written, maybe it's in the public domain by now. It's a commentary written in 1965, but it's still considered, you know, one of the best commentaries on the gospel, and it's certainly the commentary that I know best. It's a two-volume work. In the first volume, he has a very detailed outline of the first 12 chapters. Unfortunately, in the second volume, he didn't do the same. So if you see on the second page there, what you have is actually the table of contents of the book. So a little less detailed outline. But I'd like to move through this in such a way, come back to the first page, and give you an overview tonight of the structure of the whole gospel. That already you will find quite instructive, I think. It's already a reading of the text, even if we're not going to comment on particular texts right now. But to discern the structure of the gospel will help us to read it very well. And the structure is already content. It's a very highly structured gospel. By the way, for those of you that are new, this thing in my hand that I teach with, this is a fellowship tradition, fellowship retreat tradition. This is a cross from the Coptic Church in Egypt that was given to me many years ago, and bishops would always preach with the cross in their hand and bless the congregation with the cross. And the cross is always glorious. That's why it's beautiful and ornate. And I teach with it the way they did in the ancient church, to say, it doesn't matter what I'm saying, my message is the cross. Okay? And it's just it's good for gestures. You know? And I gesture naturally in any case, but I feel safer and I feel closer to my message if I preach with this in my hand. So to explain what that is. Many of you know that, but not everyone. And so I remember after the first night, somebody, what's that thing in your hand? They said, I had to listen for a whole hour wondering that. I don't want you to spend any more time on it. Yeah. So one of the first things we want to notice about the Gospel of John is that it is clearly divided into two parts, chapters 1 through 12, and then chapters 13 to the end. And for convenience sake, Raymond Brown has coined a phrase for these two halves of the book that have kind of taken on as and very, very among scholars. They talk about the book in this way. The first half of the book from chapters 1 to 12 we can call it the Book of Signs. The second half from 13 to the end we can call the Book of Glory. And in fact, the prologue, which introduces the whole gospel, which we will spend the conference on in the morning, we'll comment, and that's in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. We'll comment tomorrow morning on the prologue as a summary of the entire gospel. And in fact, in verse 11 and 12, we have the division of the Book of Signs and the Book of Glory. So if I wanted to say what happens in the Book of Signs, I could quote chapter 1, verse 11 to you. He came to what was his own, but his own people did not accept him. That's the story of the Book of Signs. Verse 12, the next verse, but to those who did accept him, he gave the power to become children of God, to those who believe in his name. What we will see is that the first 12 chapters, the Book of Signs, the gospel is full of incredible tension in which Jesus comes into the world and people must choose him or not. And in the second half of the book, we see what happens to those who choose him. And to use the language of the prologue, to those who believe in him, he gives the power to become children of God. We'll come back to that phrase in the context of a commentary on the prologue in the morning. But after the prologue, let's look at what we have there. Divisions of the Book of Signs. First of all, let's look at the big divisions. And I feel convinced that these outlines will help you not only for the retreat, but for months to come. Huh? You follow this outline and read the gospel, you're going to get to know this gospel, huh? Because you'll see its structure and you will marvel at how well structured it is, how well written it is. And somebody sat down and did work here. Somebody knows how to write. And those are the kinds of people the Holy Spirit chooses. But the Spirit works with people, huh? The Spirit works with somebody's brain and decision. And the evangelist deciding to arrange things in this way. So it's really important that we discern his decisions. little things I forget to say. You'll want to bring Bibles if you brought your own. Some people prefer their own. But I made a big stretch, and I am using... In every room, there's a Bible, huh? And you people... So I'm using not my old favorite translation, but the book that's in your room, huh? So from tomorrow on, when we'll be reading the text, if you want to have the very text I'm using, bring the book from your room, huh? It won't matter too much, but some people get annoyed if the translation's different or wonder why it's different. We don't need to... The translations are, for the most part, fine, and they're not difficult in John's Gospel, but it will be a good exercise for you to bring the Bible beginning tomorrow, okay? All right, let's look at the division of the Book of Signs here. We see the big parts, part one, part two, and then over the page you see part three and part four. What are those big parts, first of all? The first one, part one, is the opening days of the revelation of Jesus. And that moves from chapter 1, verse 19, through chapter 2, verse 11. We're going to spend some time commenting on that tomorrow. But what we're dealing with there, let's just sort of romp through how the gospel opens. The testimony of John the Baptist, that's A, concerning his own role in relation to the one to come, and concerning Jesus. We'll see the Baptist speaking of himself and the Baptist speaking of Jesus. And then in the next scene, the Baptist disciples come to Jesus as he manifests himself. We will watch John the Baptist send his disciples on to Jesus, and they meet Jesus, and then there's an intense encounter that I think we'll talk about it more at length tomorrow. There's an intense encounter in which, look at the names there, two disciples acknowledge Jesus as rabbi, then Simon Peter, Jesus as Messiah, then Philip, Jesus as the fulfillment of the law of the prophets, and then Nathanael, Jesus as the Son of God and the King of Israel. We have condensed into just a few days here, in a sense, what it's like to meet Jesus. That's what the evangelist is intending. He's not really... All that happens in those days probably couldn't have happened literally in that way. It doesn't matter, but when an 80 or 90-year-old man is telling you what it was like to meet Jesus, he said, first he met Philip, then he met Nathanael, then he met... And he said this, and he said that, and I said this, and he said this, and boom. And there's Jesus, the figure, delineated before us. And there's the encounter with Jesus delineated before us. That's how we want to read. Huh? That's what the gospel's there for. And this, you can see at the very end, the last several lines there under part one, how part two concludes, or part one concludes with the disciples come to believe Jesus as he manifests his glory at Cana. This scene both closes part one and opens part two. Great literary device, but we're going to spend some time looking at the Cana story. It's a lovely story, but it's the story that finishes, you know, with the words after the Cana miracle. You all know the miracle, but we'll learn more about the details. Jesus did this as the beginning of his signs. Thus we're calling this the Book of Signs. And that's the logic of calling this. Jesus did this as the beginning of his signs in Cana in Galilee, and so revealed his glory. We're going to talk, there's that phrase that we're wanting to zero in on. And so revealed his glory. And his disciples began to believe in him. That's meant to be us. Okay? So we'll begin to believe in Jesus as we follow the disciples all the way through to the Cana story. Part two of the gospel is titled From Cana to Cana, Various Responses to Jesus' Ministry in Different Sections of Palestine. That will cover the material in chapter 2 to chapter 4. And there's whenever this evangelist uses geographical locations, those are little symbols to us that a part is opening, a part is closing. The fact that we have the miracle at Cana, and then we have another miracle at Cana, and then another pretty different thing happens after that, that's a sign, there's a block, okay? So we can call it Cana de Cana. And from Cana de Cana, you can see we have a number of different signs are underway there. Rather blandly said, but accurately said, various responses to Jesus. There's the first sign at Cana in Galilee. Right from there, he moves to the cleansing of the temple in Jerusalem with a transition reaction to Jesus in Jerusalem. Then the part C is the discourse with Nicodemus in Jerusalem, the Baptist's final witness to Jesus, the discourse of Jesus completing the preceding, the transition Jesus leaves Judea. Then Jesus has a discourse with the Samaritan woman at Jacob's well, and the transition in which Jesus enters Galilee. And then the second sign at Cana in Galilee, where he heals the official's son from afar and the household becomes believers. You can use that outline to read those sections of the gospel. I'm going to just choose one section of it to comment on. I want to comment on Jesus' discourse with the Samaritan woman at Jacob's well. It's a beautiful encounter between Jesus and this woman. And as all of the figures in John's gospel are meant to model believers' encounters with Jesus. One of the things, if you just think about it, you probably know this, but you haven't adverted to it. All the things we know about Jesus, it's in John's gospel that we have individuals encountering Jesus, one after another after another. And those individuals are representative figures. They're representative of the reader. They're representative of the believer. There's an issue that each of us undergoes. And so we'll be trying to help you to spot yourself in the text and in the encounter with Jesus. Huh? And your story is supposed to turn out the way hers does. That's the point. And it's a rough ride for her. That too is the point. Okay? Part three over the page. You see that this is a very interesting section covering chapters 5 to 10 and very aptly named Jesus and the Principal Feasts of the Jews. In fact, the way the evangelist has organized this section is it shows us a Jesus involved with the Principal Feasts of the Jews and at every one of them working some kind of sign or uttering some sort of very surprising discourse. The sign always has something to do with the feast. And after every sign that he works, there is an argument about what it means. Jesus' sign makes people go into a kind of tension around him. And Jesus himself says amazing things in response as he explains the signs. So by moving Jesus through the feasts in that way, what the evangelist is telling us is, well, look at what the feasts are. They are the Sabbath itself, then Passover, Tabernacles, and the Feast of Dedication. And basically, what the evangelist will tell us in those chapters is that Jesus is the new Sabbath. He makes the rules for the Sabbath or not. It just comes from the fact that, as it says there, Jesus performs works that only God can do on the Sabbath. He cures someone on the Sabbath, and you know, rather than say thank you very much for that nice cure, they go, you're not supposed to do things like that on the Sabbath. And he says, I do what my Father does. And then you sort of go, woo, it's shifting the level there, huh? That's where the discourses go. So that on the Sabbath, the Passover is the occasion where Jesus multiplies the loaves for the 5,000 in the context of Passover. And then there's a long discussion on what that means, what the multiplication of the signs is, where they're saying, this is like manna from heaven. And he says, no, I'm manna from heaven. I am the true bread. And he who eats this bread will live forever. So shifting the ground, shifting the feast, shifting the understanding, and dividing believers from non-believers. This is the work, we could say, of the whole first 12 chapters, the Book of Signs. It's Jesus, to use that the summary line from the prologue, Jesus came unto his own, and his own received him not. These are the dramatic stories in which that is undertaken. The Feast of Tabernacles, a feast which involves, just as part of the celebration of the feast, a great deal of water and a great deal of candlelight and a great deal of fire. There's ablutions with water, and there's lots of lights. And will Jesus go to this feast? And yes, right in the middle of the feast, Jesus begins to say things like, "I am the light," or you want a spring of water? Well, the spring of water is within, and it dwells up in those who believe in me, and things like that. The Feast of Dedication, Jesus, the Messiah and the Son of God, is consecrated in place of the temple altar. Jesus as the Messiah, Jesus as the Son of God. And part 4 describes what goes on in chapters 11 to 12, aptly described here as Jesus moves toward the hour of death and glory. Note that's dynamic tension, huh? The dynamic tension of moving toward death and glory at the same time. What is it that ultimately is going to bring about, as this evangelist remembers his story of Jesus, what is it that's ultimately going to bring about Jesus' death, the immediate cause in the narrative line of the story? It will start with a sign which in fact is going to be the last straw for those who are not believing in Jesus. And that is raising Lazarus from the dead. Okay? This is the last sign in the Book of Signs, and it is a sign that causes, you can see there under point A, verses 45 to 54, it causes the Sanhedrin to condemn Jesus to die. And Jesus withdraws then, and the question is pending, will Jesus come to Jerusalem for the Passover? Chapter 12 are scenes preparatory to Passover and death. First, Jesus acts like he will not go to Jerusalem for the Passover, but indeed, Jesus is very much intending to go to Passover, and the way this evangelist tells the story, Jesus knows what is awaiting him in this Passover feast. Namely, he will be the Passover lamb. He will be sacrificed. And he walks resolutely toward that. And that's the only way the evangelist can remember to talk about Jesus. So beautiful scenes preparatory to his Passover and death. Beginning with a very tender opening at Bethany, Jesus is anointed for death by Mary. And his feet are anointed. And Judas is there already complaining that that ointment could have been sold and the money given to the poor. And Jesus says, "Let her do it in anticipation of my burial." Mysterious words, huh? But great stories, and the crowds acclaim Jesus as he enters Jerusalem. And then when the Greeks come and ask to see Jesus, Jesus exclaims, "Ah, my hour has come, the hour for the Son of Man to be glorified." So that's the way it works from chapters 1 to 12. That's a whole unit full of a lot of tension and a lot of beautiful action on the part of Jesus and beautiful discourses from the mouth of Jesus. We hear again this figure, this kind of godly figure emerges from the Jesus who speaks there. One of the questions that the superficial readers of the four Gospels can sometimes pose is, Jesus doesn't even sound like the same guy sometimes in the things he says in John's Gospel than he says in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So superficial might go, ha ha ha, see the Christians, they are reading fake books. You know, one of them's got to be wrong. Jesus couldn't have said that. But there's really no ha 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 there. it's just we have to remember what a gospel is, huh? It's the inspired remembering of Jesus by eyewitnesses of Jesus, in this case, many decades later. And the Jesus he remembers is the glorious Lord and God that the end of the story reveals Jesus to be. He is the risen Lord, and we will read accounts of him as risen Lord, filled with divine glory. And this, like if you were to meet the old evangelist John, as an old man, and you go, oh my God, are you John? And he goes, yep. The one who rested your head against the Lord's breast during the Last Supper, you're him? Yes, I'm a little older now, yes, I'm him. And well, tell me what it was like to be with Jesus. Tell me some stories. And he starts like this. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God. And the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. And through him, all things came to be. No, I said, tell me some stories about Jesus. And whatever came to... I'm getting there. Whatever came to be in him found life. Life was the light for humanity. That light shone in the darkness. The darkness did not overcome it. He was in the world, but the world was made by him. He came unto his own, and his own received him not. But to any who did receive him, he gave them the power to become children of God. And the Word became flesh and pitched his tent among us. And we have seen his glory. We have seen his glory. The glory of a Son coming from the Father, filled with grace and truth. Of his fullness, we have all had a share. Grace following upon grace. No one has ever seen God. It is God the Son who has revealed him. Oh, but you wanted stories. There was a man sent from God named John, who, and then the story goes, okay? But from the start, we're talking about God here. And we're talking about the one who reveals God, and we're talking about the Word, the Logos. We're talking about God, but we're talking about someone who's other than God, too. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, so that's two now, the Word and God. And the Word was God. And, well, I'm getting into tomorrow morning's conference, but we'll comment on the prologue tomorrow. But I want you to feel tonight, you can't say one thing about Jesus, and you can't remember. Nobody was there writing his words down, huh? The words were remembered and passed down, but they were really remembered in John's prayer. And so when he says what Jesus said in his argument with the Jewish people about what the sign of the multiplication of the loaves means, his language is so lofty. It doesn't need to be literally what Jesus may have said, but Jesus' meaning, his ultimate meaning, certainly is there. And now we'll see it, especially as we come into the Book of Glory. The Book of Glory, you don't have it written there, but just remember, it goes from chapter 13 to the end. This is the table of contents, not as good a division into detail as you have on the previous page. But in this part, the Book of Glory, we're dealing with three parts and an epilogue. Part one is the Last Supper, which goes from chapter 13 to chapter 17. Part two is the Passion narrative, and over the page, part three is the risen Jesus. Okay? So we go back to the beginning of part one. We see that the Book of Glory opens with the foot washing scene, and there's no question that the whole mood of the gospel shifts here. So that I'll read you chapter 13, verse 1, and you feel the solemn difference in this 12 chapters of tension, and now this. Before the feast of Passover, Jesus knew that his hour had come to pass over from this world to his Father. That passing over of Jesus from this world to his Father is the story of the next chapters of the book to the end. And it is glorious Passover. And it happens right inside the feast of the Jewish Passover. And Jesus' Passover will be his dying and his rising and his ascending to his Father. And that will be the new Passover of any who believe in Jesus. That's the Book of Glory. And it will begin with the foot washing, which is one of the scenes I've selected for us to comment on in detail. And we'll look at it's magnificently constructed. And in fact, what we see is that the washing of feet is Jesus enacting a little parable in advance of his death and resurrection. In the Book of Signs, we saw a pattern that is arranged in different ways by the author, in which Jesus works a sign, and then there's a discourse about its meaning. And then Jesus works a sign, and then there's a discourse about his meaning. Now, in the Book of Glory, there is just one long discourse that precedes the sign. And the long discourse is the rest of chapter 13 all the way through to chapter 17. You see that Raymond Brown is, again, the author whose pages we're following here. He divides this last discourse into different units. For example, number 50... it refers you to chapter 14, 1 to 14, then chapter 14, 15 to 24. Those divisions can be helpful to you. Those are some of the loftiest teaching of Jesus, and Jesus is no longer speaking to the crowds and letting himself be disputed with. Jesus is speaking only to those who believe in him. He is speaking in the intimacy of the Last Supper. He's speaking to the 12, or actually they're down to 11 by the time he gets going on this. Judas is out, and that part dramatically portrayed. But so in the same way, Jesus will work a sign and then have a discourse. Now we have a big, long discourse about a big sign, about what is the sign that he calls his hour, or the sign that he calls his being lifted up. You recognize that phrase, meant not remember, it comes from John, but when I am lifted up. my hour to be lifted up. And being lifted up in the mouth of Jesus and in the mouth of the evangelist is the sign. And being lifted up is a triple entendre. It is it means being lifted up on the cross, being lifted up in resurrection, being lifted up in ascension glory. Okay? That's the sign. And to understand that sign, we have the discourses. Okay? So we're gonna dip into those discourses, and we will comment. We'll just choose some good verses from different parts of the discourses, and then spend some time on the final prayer of chapter 17, verses 20 to 26. Incredible prayer of Jesus as he goes to his death. And that's a prayer which finishes chapter 17, verse 26. Jesus says, praying to his Father, I made known to them your name, and I will make it known that the love with which you loved me may be in them and I in them. That's where this discourse to his own finishes. And then dramatic shift of scene, part two. When he had said this, Jesus went out with his disciples across the Kidron Valley, and boom, then the passion narrative begins. And does John tell the story of this passion narrative? It's magnificent style of telling us how Jesus goes to his passion. So we're going to work to catch the style of John's. We all know the story, but when we zero into style of telling the story, then we have a new insight, and that's the insight the Spirit wants from us reading John. So that's in the works for that will be on Saturday. Then over the page, part three, the stories of the risen Jesus. And again, we can divide into different scenes there. But there's the scene at the empty tomb, and then the appearance to the disciples gathered behind locked doors, and a statement of the author's purpose, which is the conclusion to the Book of Glory. That's at chapter 20, verses 30 to 31. Let me just read those to you to see. This is why the whole gospel has been written. Now Jesus did many other signs. Signs is a John word, huh? Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples that are not written in this book. But these are written that you may come to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that through this belief you may have life in his name. That's the purpose of this retreat. Okay? I am doing this retreat. I just turn into the evangelist John for you, huh? You know? I am doing this retreat. I'm not going to talk about everything that Jesus ever did. But the things I do talk about, I'm going to talk about so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God. And why would I want you to believe that? Because you have life in his name when you believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God. Now, it isn't easy to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God. But these things written will help us. And if you open your heart, he will give you the power to become children of God. Some extra stories got tacked on to the end of the gospel. The gospel of John ends twice. You think that, well, that's the end, isn't it? But no, there's more stories. And so chapter 21, Raymond Brown, I think rightly, labels it an epilogue. And it's a different appearance, a lovely appearance of the risen Lord to the disciples on the Sea of Tiberias. And the conversation with Peter, where he asks Peter three times, do you love me? And and then the second conclusion to the gospel. So there's an overview of the whole thing. Maybe I would suggest that you look this over in some of your quiet time. Maybe get your Bibles open and start flipping through it, and just to get the structure. I'm calling structure already content. If I can rely in the rest of my conferences on your sort of remembering the structure, I'll keep reminding you of it. But if I can rely on referring to this structure, then when I just zero into one passage, we'll know where in the whole that passage is, and then it will speak for all that we can't say. That's the logic of proceeding in this way, okay? So let's conclude tonight with just listening to, again, the prologue. I didn't realize I had it memorized like that, so I wasn't. I'm glad I did. I pray it to myself, so I suppose I did. But I wasn't showing off. But it came out well. I didn't know it was all there, and I probably made some mistakes. But it doesn't matter. That's the way we remember. Huh? But to close quietly. The beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came to be through Him, and without Him nothing came to be. What came to be through Him was life, and this life was the light of the human race. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. He was in the world, and the world came to be through Him, but the world did not know Him. He came unto His own, but His own people did not accept Him. But to those who did accept Him, He gave power to become children of God, to those who believe in His name, who were born not by natural generation, nor by human choice, nor by a man's decision, but born of God. And the Word became flesh and made His dwelling among us. And we saw His glory, the glory as of the Father's only Son, full of grace and truth. From His fullness we have all received grace in place of grace. Because while the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, the only Son, God, who is at the Father's side, has revealed Him.